Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. The latest confusion sowed by the president over Russian meddling is whether they're trying to interfere in this year's election. First, the president seemed to say no in response to that question yesterday, then changed it to yes and claimed he had only said no as a way of refusing to answer the question earlier. Whatever. At least we're talking about this year's election security now, which brings us to our next guest. Michael Chertoff was Secretary of Homeland Security in George W. Bush's second term. He had previously had other significant jobs like Deputy Attorney General and U.S. Attorney for New Jersey. He's got a security consultancy company now and a new book called Exploding Data, Reclaiming Our Cybersecurity in the Digital Age. As some of you know, if you listened to our Trump-Putin summit coverage on Monday, Secretary Chertoff was scheduled for a book interview at that time and was nice enough to spend the time doing summit analysis for us instead. But 3 days later, guess what? His book is still relevant. So Secretary Chertoff, thanks again and welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian.
Your book is still relevant, right? They didn't solve our cybersecurity woes at the summit?
Not at all. And in fact, I think they made, as far as we can tell, not much progress in dealing with some of the outstanding issues we have with the Russians in terms of cybersecurity, which involves not only hacking, but what we've been discussing is information manipulation or information operations.
We'll get back to Russia and this year's elections, but I do want to give you an opportunity to lay out the bigger picture as you describe it in the book. When you say cybersecurity in the digital age, how broadly do you mean that?
Well, what I'm pointing out is the fact that in many ways, the data that we generate as individuals has become as valuable in the private sector as oil or gold. It's become really something that can be monetized, and therefore, there's a certain potential for abuse. My sense is that most people have no idea of how much digital exhaust or data exhaust they generate, and the ways in which it can be collected, analyzed, and then used to subtly manipulate or even coerce us in our behavior.
You assert a number of times in the book that law and policy have not evolved at the pace that the data revolution has. What are some examples of that?
Well, for example, we still think of the principal objective in terms of dealing with surveillance and collection of data as privacy in the sense of keeping things hidden or behind closed doors. My point is, I think that we've lost the ability to count on hiding most of the data or information about ourselves. So we need to refocus the law on who controls the data once it's generated. If we accept that we're going to be constantly generating information about ourselves, should we put some limits on what the collectors of the information, particularly in the private sector, can do with that? How they transfer it, how they monetize it, how they store it. And I think that's where the law needs to catch up with the technology.
You seem to take the position that we shouldn't be too concerned about how much of our personal data corporations or the government are collecting. It's more about how they use it. Do I have that right?
That's right, because I think the ability to stop the massive collection has fled. It's not just what we deliberately put out there on particular sites or in terms of what we do on the Internet. It's what everybody else can say about us or talk about us or collect about us, and we really can't control their ability to do that. That's why the focus has to change from keeping things secret into controlling the use that's made of the data, and that's really the thrust of the book.
You even write that wittingly and unwittingly, people are invading their own privacy. How do you mean that?
Well, not only do we continually add devices that generate information about where we are, how we're sleeping, how much exercise we're getting, what we're eating, and where we're going and coming, but there are things that we don't even realize that we're putting in our homes, so-called smart devices that are increasingly sending out information about when we're home, how much sleep we get, what kind of food we eat. And a lot of these things we acquire without really looking critically at the amount of data that it's generating and the use that might be made of that.
Listeners, any questions for former Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff and his new book, Exploding Data, Reclaiming Our Cybersecurity in the Digital Age, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Before we just move on from the premise of your book, that could be controversial, to suggest giving up on the idea that governments and corporations are collecting our data and only focusing on how they use it for where regulation comes in. I think Europe is more aggressive than the United States, for example, on collection as well as use of personal data, than the United States. Have you been getting pushback to this idea that, we should stop trying to protect our data because that cat is too out of the bag?
Well, I don't think I've said we should stop trying to protect it. I think what I've acknowledged, though, in the book is if there's an expectation we can really keep most of our data hidden, I think we're kidding ourselves. So I'm not suggesting we totally abandon the effort to keep things quiet or secret. But what I'm saying is that's not going to do the job. And frankly, the Europeans, I think, have recognized this by changing a lot of their focus into the issue of how data is used. Mm-hmm. There's a new regulation which now requires private sector collectors of information to quite explicitly tell you and ask you whether you are willing to accept certain uses of the data. And I think that, although there's some elements of that that are a little bureaucratic, I think the general principle is actually one we should consider adopting in our own society.
So go a little more into that. What is Europe doing that we can learn from?
Well, we typically sign up when we join a platform with the idea that we get a 50 or 60 page list of terms and conditions, and the requirement to sign up is that we accept this. What the Europeans are doing is they are literally sending out messages saying, in very simple, plain terms, here's what we want to do with your data. Is that okay? And you have to affirmatively say yes, or they can't make that use of the data. But the other issue, which I think is as important, is do we really have a choice? There are certain platforms that are so ubiquitous and so critical to the way we live now that declining what they want to do almost puts you out of the ability to conduct your daily life. And so when you accept under those circumstances, you're not really consenting. You don't have a choice. And so a second point I'm making is we need to start to look at those platforms and see whether the government has to say, you've got to give a real choice. And that means you've got to give people the option of joining the platform by paying a fee, as opposed to having to give up their data as the only way in which you can participate.
Peter in Norwalk, you're on WNYC with former Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff. Hi, Peter.
Hi, thank you for taking my call, Brian. Secretary Chertoff, what I'd like to know is, would you support a global cyber arms treaty, much in the same way that we banned chemical weapons, I believe it was in the 70s? The reason I'm bringing up this now is because the U.S. has a pretty substantial advantage in cyber arms, or at least that's what the newspapers say. So wouldn't it make a lot more sense if we took the leadership to try to get that down on paper now while we have the advantage so that, we can start to worry about non-state actors versus state actors? I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you, Peter.
Yeah. Well, I think that we do need to look at the issue of what are the restraints and restrictions we want to put on the use of cyber arms and cyber conflict. And various people have raised the concept of a Geneva Convention with respect to cyber. I'm involved now in a global commission on stability in cyberspace that is proposing some restrictions on the use that we can deploy in terms of using various kinds of tools in cyberspace. So I think this is an effort that is beginning to develop and is important. It's challenging for a couple of reasons. First of all, often what is a malicious tool And the use of that tool is not necessarily obvious until you actually see it in action. So there becomes a little bit of difficulty in knowing what ought to be banned and what can't be banned. But the second thing is there are some fundamental differences among countries about what they consider to be a cyber attack. If you talk to the Russians, for example, they consider cyber warfare to be the propagation of information or data that they would rather not have their citizens read or watch. So it's essentially a form of censorship. We would not accept that in the United States. So I do think there's some progress that is being made slowly, but I also want to caution this is going to be a slow process, and it will probably begin among like-minded Western democracies first, and then ultimately some of these concepts will be, I think, maybe more globally accepted.
In the indictments of the 12 Russians handed down by Mueller last week, some of the charges were not just for going after the Clinton campaign's data, but for hacking into actual state and local election systems. How much was that new information to you, and how troubling do you find it?
Well, I think we've seen reporting about efforts to hack into systems and probe voter registration rolls and similar databases. And that, I think, is something that concerns a lot of people. And one of the efforts being made now with the state attorney, with the state secretaries of state and with the Department of Homeland Security is to begin to move people to a more secure system for collecting the data and holding the data. So that's clearly an issue. The broader issue also is the effort to subvert social cohesiveness by deliberately promoting anger and discord over the Internet and ginning up people on both sides of issues to become more aggressive and even violent.
You know, there's a dispute in the news today between Democrats and Republicans in Congress over whether state and local election systems need more federal security funding. Democrats say yes, Republicans say the federal government is spending enough. Do you have a position on that?
I would want to be generous with the states in terms of the spending on retrofitting and upgrading their capabilities. Because to me, this is a kind of crown jewel of our critical infrastructure. So I would not be stingy with the resources necessary. But in addition to money, you also have to have advice and guidance so people understand the best route to take in order to protect their critical infrastructure.
How much do you think Trump or congressional Republicans are withholding leadership on this because Russian interference is good for the party?
I think anybody who thinks Russian interference is good for the Republican Party is deluding themselves. What the Russians are interested in doing is creating disorder and confusion among the American electorate and ultimately discrediting the idea of democracy. And this is, there's a doctrine the Russians use called the Gerasimov Doctrine that talks about information operations as essentially an enabler of conflict and struggle. So this is not helping any Americans, and I think we ought to put party affiliation aside, and just as we did on 9/11, recognize threats to the integrity of the American political process are threats to all Americans and to our constitutional values.
You think Republicans don't recognize that enough at this particular moment?
I think many Republicans do. John McCain, Bob Corker, I think a lot of Republicans do. I know that you know, President Trump has an unusual sensitivity about anything he perceives as putting an asterisk next to the 2016 election. But at this point, I think what's important is looking at what's going on this year and next year and the year after, because that's going to really affect the vitality of our democracy.
John in Bedford, you're on WNYC with former Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff. Hi, John.
Yes, hello. You know, before our private information was put online, we had control of that. And it's our constitutional right to have privacy. If we were to move to a way that business could still be conducted online, but our private information would no longer be online in any way accessible, how could that be done?
Well, this is really, it's a good question. This is really about the uses which can be made of the information. So I'll give you an example. If you go to an application that gives you, geolocation for purposes of driving instructions, and you need to be able to have data about where you're located in order for that to function, I think that's quite reasonable. I mean, the functionality of the application requires understanding where you are at any particular moment. But if that's being collected and used in order to, for example, send to vendors, so when you drive by a particular store, they can send you a blast about what is available for sale, then I would say that is misusing the information. Now, some people may like that. And so if you're offered the opportunity and they say to you up front, we want to use this to inform vendors of your location so you can get information about sales, and if you want to say yes to that, that's great. But you should have the right to say, no, I'd rather not do that. And part of the problem is we don't always know the full use that's going to be made of the information down the line. And that's something that we need to be advised about and we need to be mindful of.
We just have a few minutes left, Secretary Chertoff, and because you were Homeland Security Secretary, I'm interested, and I'm sure our listeners would also like, a little of your perspective on what's going on at the southern border. What was your policy at that time, and listeners were talking about second George W. Bush administration, regarding the issue that's front and center right now? Parents with children who cross the border illegally, when, if ever, were they separated against their will under you?
Well, we didn't normally separate parents and children. Now, there was an issue about certain people bringing children across the border because they believed that, and sometimes they weren't even their own children, they believed that if they were apprehended with children, they would be released at large, and then many of them wouldn't come back to actually ever have their hearing about whether they should be allowed to remain. So what we did in those instances was we created facilities that could house families and or had some other way of monitoring to make sure that we knew where they were, and that way it assured that they turned up for a hearing or some other kind of judicial proceeding. But we didn't separate families. Now, there have been some subsequent developments in the law that restrict how long you can hold families and children that have made this more complicated. But, Brian, the truth is there's a larger issue here. There should be a way to deal more broadly with this problem comprehensively. We've tried to do this for many years. I spent a lot of time on it. And that involves having a process for bringing people in lawfully to do work, even as you enforce the law against people coming illegally, and also processing asylum claims in a way that is efficient and relatively timely. So I think if we can kind of stand back from the rhetoric and understand that you need to build an entire system in order to address the issue, we would avoid some of these problems.
And so last question, there's also now this new movement to abolish ICE precisely because immigration enforcement was moved out of the old Immigration Service and moved into the Homeland Security Department, which critics say has given it its current hardcore approach to regular undocumented immigrants who are not national security risks, like the 9/11 hijackers obviously were, like the kind of people who Homeland Security is actually for dealing with. Do you see their point at all?
I think it's a misunderstanding of what actually goes on. I think ICE, under the Bush administration, under the Obama administration, took its cue from what the policies were of the president and of the secretary. And, you know, if you wanted to focus on hardcore people, they will execute on that. If somebody takes a policy that you focus on everybody, they will execute on that. This is not about abolishing an organization that you have to have, because you have to be able to police your borders and you have to deal with human trafficking and human smuggling. So it's about what the policies are that you're going to ask these people to carry out. I also think you need to be careful not to glamorize the process by which people are wind up getting funneled into the U.S. The traffickers who are basically bringing people in are not doing it because they're humanitarians. They're doing it for money. And often what they do is they victimize the people that they are transporting. And so when the message goes out that there's no enforcement, that's a gift to the smugglers, because they say, oh, you see, we'll smuggle you in. Now, we might rape you along the way, or we might steal all your money, but you'll get in at the end of the day. So we need to be careful about the unintended consequences of some of the proposals that are being battened about.
But there's got to be a way to deal with asylum seekers as asylum seekers and not block their access to the country just because what you say is true, which is that there is so much having to pay off the cartels in order to get them across, right?
I agree with you, and I think that there needs to be a process where people can present themselves at a port of entry, make a credible claim for asylum, and then they can be admitted and they can be processed and adjudicated in an appropriate way. I think it's very important to resource that effort and to make it very clear that there is a way to come to seek asylum, and preferably a way that doesn't require you to put yourself in the hands of traffickers and smugglers. You know, what would be a great idea, Brian, would be if you could have reputable NGOs assist in transporting people to ports of entry. They would present themselves in a completely transparent manner to the authorities. The authorities would then accept them for purposes of processing and adjudicate them quickly. That would be a humane way to live up to our obligations to refugees without necessarily funding smuggling and trafficking.
Yeah. So if I could extend this to one more quick follow-up, why do you think so many actual asylum seekers are crossing illegally rather than at the ports of entry? Those are the ones who are being separated from their children if they come across illegally. Is there not enough resource at the legal points of entry to accommodate all the people who we should fairly be letting to present themselves there?
I think there is a shortage of resources at the ports of entry, but I also think, frankly, when people are traveling up, let's say, from Central America through Mexico, their means of transportation often puts them in the hands of the smugglers. And the smugglers aren't interested in taking people to ports of entry because they're not interested in identifying themselves as smugglers. They benefit from bringing people in illegally because they get to victimize them and carry on their illegal business. So to me, you know, part of the issue, it's always a systems problem. You've got to look at how do you get people up to a port of entry where they can present themselves lawfully? How do you do it in a way that doesn't expose them to danger? And then do you have enough resources to process them? So this is something actually where NGOs could work with the U.S. government to come up with a way that would allow legitimate people who need help not to put themselves at the mercy of those who want to victimize them.
Former U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff, his new book is called Exploding Data, Reclaiming Our Cybersecurity in the Digital Age. Thank you so much, and thank you again for doing some summit coverage with us on the fly on Monday. We really appreciate both appearances.
Happy to do it, Brian. Thanks a lot.